You're listening to the Leonard LoPage Show on WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard this afternoon. For today's Underreported, we're going to talk about Afghanistan, which certainly does have a presence in the mainstream media, but probably not as much as it deserves, given that what happens there is crucial to U.S. interests. And there are many stories that we just don't hear about. With me now is former NPR correspondent Sarah Chase. She's lived and worked in Kandahar, where she's founded a soap-making company to help rebuild the war-torn country. She has an article on Afghanistan in the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and you can see some of her beautiful photos of the people there on the Leonard LoPage Show page at WNYC.org. Sarah, welcome back to the Leonard LoPage Show.
It's great to be back.
For listeners, and there may be a couple who aren't familiar with you and what you do, can you remind us how long you've been in Kandahar?
Yeah, I actually went in a couple of days after the fall of the Taliban as an NPR reporter, and then got invited to stay by President Karzai's uncle, who had been one of my sort of background sources when I was covering the region, and he just kind of tossed it out. Wouldn't you come back and help us? And I said yes, before I really even registered the question, and have been there ever since. So it's really from December 2001.
What was it about, you know, it's one thing to be invited to come back to a country, but I would think you would need to fall in love with it to make a decision like that.
There
was that what happened?
Some of that. I mean, you know, this is a kind of trope about Afghanistan, that it's this magical place that people go to and they, it's like the sirens, they can't leave, you know. But I have to say, there was a bit of the geostrategic in my in my decision too, which was that it seemed to me that the 9/11 terrorist attacks in New York and Washington were like our century's version of the assassination of the Archduke. In other words, this was the event that was really going to
shift things,
determine a lot of the way the 21st century was going to look. And it seemed to me that the basic choice is, do we want to live out another century that is determined by a kind of with us or against us, bipolar, clash of civilizations sort of model? Or do we recognize that this is a world made up of interconnected, diverse, rich, flawed civilizations that have something to learn from and teach each other? And that's the kind of world I want to live in. And it seemed to me that Kandahar, which was where those terrorist attacks were planned, was the place to try to work in favor of that vision. There was something really symbolic about it.
And as a storyteller, you can go there and then tell us the stories of what happens there.
It's been really interesting because, you know, as a mainstream journalist, you're supposed to hold yourself outside of the story and report on it from this sort of low hover, you know what I mean? Sort of up in the air where you don't, you know, with a neutrality that often is feigned, but certainly you're not supposed to take part in a story. And what's been really interesting to me is to experience being able to talk about a place, but from a perspective rooted deeply inside of it. And I found that it's almost like a different kind of journalism, because you're very upfront from the beginning about who you are, what your location is in this tableau that you're about to paint, and then from this location, here's the tableau that I see. And that's been really enriching for me, and I've actually found that readers and listeners have appreciated it also.
Can you tell us a little bit about Kandahar province? What is it like? Are there cities or towns? And what does it look like?
It looks like the moon, basically. As one Brit said coming in, so I think former SAS, you know, Special Forces officer said, wow, this place is the moon with goats on. And that's basically, it is the most arid, stark, and barren place that I've ever set eyes on. There is a major city, which is Kandahar, which is an ancient city that, in fact, is the place where Afghanistan was founded as a country in the middle of the 18th century. So it's a really symbolic town, and there's a little bit, it's relatively close to the border with Pakistan, meaning about an hour's drive away. And so it has a little bit of that Wild West, you know, kind of frontier feeling to it. It's a place where the border is quite porous, you know, traffic of all kinds, you know, passes back and forth and things like that. And so there is something fetching about the place in that regard. And the people are tough, funny, bloody-minded survivors. That being said, there is a river that passes through the province just to the north of Kandahar City, and it's a kind of meandering, very fluctuating in terms of how much water there is in it, and it's got these sort of smooth stones in its bed, and that's called the Argandab River. And so Argandab District, just north of the city of Kandahar, is a sudden pomegranate forest. I mean, it's just crazy. You come up over a sort of ridge of rocks, and then spread out in front of you is this tangle of fruit trees. So quite oddly, it's a very barren place that produces the most incredible fruit, grapes and pomegranates and plums and apricots and almonds, and it's that kind of contrast.
And I would guess all the more powerful because of that contrast, that you're driving through or riding through this lunar landscape and then you see fruit trees.
Yeah, yeah. And it takes a lot of work to tend those fruit trees. It's not rainfall agriculture, it's irrigation agriculture. And so I found that the farmers are in many ways the most trustworthy people in Kandahar province, because you can't lie to the earth. You know, the earth
Right.
there is very demanding, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of straightforwardness in a way. And so I've found that people with orchards tend to be people that I trust more than others.
You're in France right now. We're speaking to you in Paris. When did you leave Afghanistan?
The very end of October, and I left. I took part in a training exercise for NATO officers who are going to be taking command of the whole southern zone on the 1st of February. So it's a really interesting process. It's a 2-week-long process, which includes briefing and things like that, and then an actual like simulation of about 4 or 5 days in the life of a headquarters to really sort of put them through the types of events that they're going to experience and get them to streamline a little bit their communications practices. I mean, everything down to making them attend like a mock shura of tribal elders and things like that. It's a very interesting process.
And are these are there Afghanis who are with you who are doing
this? Yes. In fact, many of the sort of trainers are military people who have already served their rotations down there and things like that. But there's what's called the white cell are civilians, which include Afghans and internationals playing the types of roles that they actually play in real life down there.
How fascinating. So you're making a pretend Afghanistan
in
Paris for people who will be going.
Well, this was in Norway.
Oh, in Norway.
This didn't take place in Paris, but that's part of what I'm doing in Europe.
And do you plan to go back to Kandahar?
I do, at the end of the month.
Tell us about what's happening there right now. You mentioned that this was where the attacks on the World Trade Center took place. Is the Taliban still a force in Kandahar?
I wouldn't say still. I would say it has become a force again. It's a really depressing situation because, you know, as I just said, I was there, you know, sort of 2 days after the Taliban were fled the country. And I have to tell you, even in, you know, conservative and glowering Kandahar, people were overjoyed at the prospect of rejoining the international community, of having the attention of the whole world directed at them. They saw this U.S.-led kind of nation-building process as maybe like a winch, a sort of cosmic winch that could drag them up out of this nightmare that they've been living in for the last 30 years.
Right.
And what happened is that we disappointed them. I mean, we brought in a bunch of thoroughly discredited thugs and installed them in positions of political power and refused then to kind of rein them in or impose any accountability or any recourse on them, or accountability on the officials and recourse for the ordinary citizens. So what you've got is a situation now where people are just utterly fed up with the corrupt, brutal, and short-sighted government that we've imposed on them. and are coming under attack from a sort of reconstituted Taliban that were really reorganized and trained and financed across the border in Pakistan, which are kind of acting almost like invaders. It's almost like Pakistan is invading Afghanistan by proxy using these reconstituted Taliban, but the people are caught in the middle. It's like the people are saying, you know, the government preys on us in the daytime and the Taliban prey on us at night. How are we supposed to survive? And so people are becoming more and more desperate, more and more frightened, because the Taliban tactics, first of all, the Taliban are encroaching. The tactics are very scary. Afghans are very traumatized. And the government is not really doing what a government ought to do. Like, it's not providing the services and the support and the protection that a government ought to. And so people are more and more left, you know, kind of feeling vulnerable, and they're either running away. A lot of people have fled the country again. A lot of people have moved into the cities from the outlying areas. And a lot of people are making deals or joining the Taliban out of frustration, out of fear, out of intimidation, out of you know, blood feud in a way. If they've lost a brother or a cousin to, let's say, a bombing by the U.S. or NATO forces, they need to extract vengeance. And so it feels, living in Kandahar City, it sort of feels like you're in one of those rooms with the walls kind of closing in on you.
Is this very different from what happened under Soviet occupation and the way that the Taliban, I mean, do you see a different story playing out now than played out the last time?
Quite similar. In other words, what happened last time is the Soviets withdrew. They were defeated and withdrew in 1989. And then there was this sort of chaos. There was vacuum and chaos with the Pakistani government backing its favorite son to become the head of Afghanistan, and the Afghans mostly not wanting this guy. And so it sort of disintegrated into factional conflict. And the people were so distraught at living in this kind of unpredictable and violent chaos that when the Taliban presented themselves in 1994, it was like, you know, anything is better than the degree of chaos that we're living under. The human spirit can't take too much violent and unpredictable chaos, and often will prefer oppression to chaos. And unfortunately, what we've handed Afghanistan in the wake of the fall of the Taliban has been the chaos again. And I think that is why you're seeing a certain softening of public opinion, particularly in the south, toward the Taliban. I mean, in 2003, you know, when internationals would talk about the security situation, they were talking about the very beginnings of sort of Taliban resurgence. When Afghans were talking about insecurity, they were talking about what they were suffering at the hands of the government, because they kept getting shaken down by these militias and by policemen and by, you know, civil servants and things like that. And at that time, Afghans would say, gosh, you know, at least under the Taliban, we were safe. At least we could cross town. And, you know, it was an oppressive regime, but at least we could cross town without fearing for our lives or our property. What people are saying is, at least the Taliban didn't take bribes like this government does. At least the Taliban had an administration that functioned. And I find that a really distressing comparison.
What has your own experience been, Sarah? Do you yourself experience what the corruption that you're talking about?
Oh, totally. Oh, my God. We had to register our cooperative with the Department of Agriculture, and it took 6 months, 6 to 7 months, to even get the paperwork moving because we refused to pay a bribe. And finally, I had to go to the department. I was sending our Afghan treasurer, and he just could not get this to happen. And I had to go and basically have a tantrum for this to happen. And then we had to deposit some money in the national bank as a kind of reserve for the cooperative. And I sent the treasurer again, and he comes back and he says, you know, they want a bribe of about $10. And I said, we're not doing it, you know. And so I went back the next day and I told the superior of the little bank clerk that, you know, I would be happy to give the $10, but I need a receipt because I have a board of directors and I have to account for money that we spent. So, of course, that meant that the bribe couldn't change hands because you couldn't provide a receipt. And the, you know, manager said, well, actually, she's right and, you know, we shouldn't take this money. So then the little clerk has to, like, fill out five different slips of paper. And so then he wants basically 50 cents per slip of paper. And I said, fine, I'd love to give it to you. Here it is. I pulled the money out of my pocket and I said, you can have it. I just need a receipt for it. And of course, he couldn't find the receipt. And so he said, well, we just won't be able to finish your work until tomorrow. And I'm not quite sure physiologically how this happened, but next thing I know, I'm sitting on top of the guy's desk amidst his paperwork. And I said, well, that's okay. I won't leave your desk until tomorrow. And faced with this, you know, situation, of course, they finished our work right away. But the fact is that Afghans aren't really able to do that because they're
afraid. Well, that was going to be my question. Here you are, yeah, an American woman, and you can play this role.
Exactly.
Is this something that your colleagues or your finance person, could he do the same thing?
Not at all. And in fact, people would be afraid of being imprisoned or being beaten or something like that. People are not at all in that role. And so it's really irritating to me. We also were shaken down at customs. I mean, again, I'm friends with a cross-border tribe. I can traffic anything into Afghanistan that I want to. And I wanted to be like a good citizen. And then we were bringing some coconut oil in through Pakistan. And I, you know, said, have it sent to customs and we'll pay customs. And they were trying to shake us down and all the stuff. And I had been talking to the governor about corruption, and he was telling me, you know, well, you can never find evidence because the victims are complicit because they want their work done faster and all of this stuff. So I go barging into the governor's office and I say, look, you want proof? You want evidence? Come with me, right? You know, now come with me and I'll show you what's going on at customs. And basically he dispatched a police official with me who swiftly got our logjam unblocked, but just us. I mean, basically everyone else was sent out of the room. Our issue was resolved, and then I was ushered out. So, like, God forbid that this serve as something that would actually have an impact for other people. And so that's what's really frustrating, is I do think this is I really think that this is solvable, and what is needed is a very strong and across-the-board commitment by international officials to get serious about this. And it's so interesting talking to people like political advisors to the you know, command of the southern zone or diplomatic representatives in Kandahar and this and that, and people just keep coming up with these reasons why, well, you know, this is an Afghan government and we can't boss them around, or, you know, it's just not possible to really do this, or you just sense this reluctance to get in there with sleeves rolled up and on a case-by-case basis require government officials to behave better.
Well, it also sounds like a tremendous amount of work.
It is. It is. And there was another example where I got involved on behalf of the Manufacturers Union of Kandahar, amongst whom I discovered that, you know, the government was putting these incredible obstacles in the way of productive economic activity. And so I kind of just fixed on one issue, which was they were building factories in an industrial zone designed for them, you know, that was even, you know, U.S. development money was put into this zone and stuff like that. But the government wanted to extract the highest price possible for the land and things like that. And, you know, as you say, I can kind of barge into these people's offices and cajole them and harass them and get something to happen. And these poor manufacturers had been trying to get a meeting with the governor for over a year and weren't able to get in to see him. And it took me a year of shepherding this process to get them first to be able to actually pay money for the land and then get title deed for the land to be delivered to them.
Sarah,
but it was possible, you know?
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to go back to something that you raised earlier when you were talking about the corruption leading to people being more inclined to embrace the Taliban. And the Taliban, you say, are coming from Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see as Pakistan's role in what's going on now?
Oh, it's enormous. And it's been a very consistent policy over, you know, a couple of decades, which has been manipulating or instrumentalizing religious extremism in service of its very secular regional power goals. And the fact is that Pakistan has a kind of a paranoia or inferiority complex about India and is constantly trying to sort of expand its domination in Kashmir and Afghanistan in particular, and consistently since the 1970s has been instrumentalizing religious extremism to do this. And so the notion that after 9/11, one visit by then Secretary of State Colin Powell was enough to kind of caused the Pakistani government to reverse 30 years of policy was a bit unrealistic on our part. And so what has been happening is that Pakistan has been quite helpful in capturing and turning over Al-Qaeda leadership, while meanwhile is continuing to fund, support, orchestrate, and manage the Taliban. And U.S. officials had basically up till now been turning a blind eye to that. Now, that being said, I would say that the frustration on the part of the Afghan population is such that the Taliban are gaining more support. So I would have, if we had had this conversation a year ago, I would have said this so-called insurgency is really an invasion by proxy, mounted by Pakistan. But now it is gaining more and more local support.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today on the Leonard Lopate Show. Sarah Shays, who is in Paris right now but lives in Kandahar.
And just to mention,
we only have one, 5 seconds.
Of The Punishment of Virtue, which you didn't mention before, which just came out in paperback.
Thank you. Christopher Plummer has appeared in over 100 films. He'll be here tomorrow to talk about his latest, The Man in the Chair. Also, a look at a new series that focuses on world literature, one country at a time. We'll hear about the jinxed life of jazz vocalist Jackie Paris, and on Please Explain, how you can become an amateur astronomer. By the way, 3 days into Hanukkah, 2.5 weeks before Christmas, I hope you're all having a good holiday season so far. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Scott Goldberg, and Sarah English. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. I'm Julie Burstein. I hope you stay warm today.